Last but not least is Ashley Samuelson McGuire. And I've got her bio here, so I'm going to pull that up as soon as I can figure out how to get it up here. So Ashley has written about religious freedom for a wide range of outlets, including The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, Huffington Post, and First Things. She's also the founder and editor-in-chief of Alt Catholica, a web magazine devoted to the exploration of faith and gender. She's also a senior fellow at the Catholic Association. In that capacity, she appears regularly on radio and television to promote religious liberty and other issues of interest to lay Catholics. She's appeared on Fox, CBS, PBS, CNN, EWTN, and HuffPo Live, among others, and has been quoted in a wide range of media outlets such as the LA Times, Politico, and Bloomberg. Ashley is an editor for the Institute for Family Studies blog and is a staff writer for the pop culture blog Acculturated, and has spoken on religion, religious liberty, and gender in academic settings such as Yale Law School, NYU, and GW. She's the author of Sex Scandal, The Drive to Abolish Male and Female. Do we have that in the back as well? We don't have that. I don't think so. And then last but not least, Ashley, and perhaps most importantly, is a wife to her husband, Brian, and mother of three children. Ashley, thank you so much for joining us today. Let's have you up.
Thank you. So since I'm the last speaker, I thought I would start out by shocking you all a little bit. So I'll start with talking about a story you all may have heard about from last year about the Boy Scouts. In the spring of last year, it was conveniently the week that my book came out, the Boy Scouts decided that they would essentially go co-ed by allowing members of either biological sex to participate. To quote their CEO, "We realize that referring to birth certificates as the reference point is no longer sufficient." When I heard this, I wondered how long until the Girl Scouts were pressured to do the same thing, only to learn after some brief research that the Girl Scouts had already announced that biological boys could participate if they self-identified as girls. But my heart broke when I read the CEO of the Girl Scouts take to USA Today to defend their very existence. She wrote an article, the headline of which was, "Girls are stars in Girl Scouts. They'd be supporting players in Boy Scouts." She wrote, "At Girl Scouts, girls aren't the ancillary tag-along or supporting player. They are the central character. For more than a century, Girl Scouts has delivered unparalleled experiences that allow girls to discover their passions, develop leadership and people skills, explore their worlds, and embark on new adventures. Adult mentors and strong female role models show them they can be anything they want to be." CNN put it more bluntly, writing, "Now that the Boy Scouts admits girls, the competition is on." The second anecdote came from the UK, and it came about the week after the Boy Scouts went co-ed. The British Medical Association published guidelines for employers on how to be more inclusive. Those included ditching the phrase expectant mother and using instead pregnant people, and replacing the word breastfeeding with chest feeding. Lest someone be offended by the fact that women and only women can bear and birth children. The UK government, a few months after that, opposed the phrase pregnant woman in a UN treaty and instead suggested that the treaty include the phrase pregnant people. This may seem laughable, and yet it comes in the wake of the Midwives Alliance of North America introducing the phrase birthing individual into their lexicon. When the alliance received angry blowback from some feminists, such as iconic feminist midwife Ina Mae Gaskin, one writer who described himself as an expectant parent lamented at the Huffington Post that some women had the, quote, audacity to assert that only women have the ability to give birth and that such capacity is what women should celebrate about themselves. Here in the U.S., we're even more ahead of the curve, as just a few months ago I read a CBS News headline, "Pregnant Man Gives Birth." And then many of you may have seen the story in the news last week. This is the NPR headline. 17-year-old transgender boy wins Texas girls wrestling. And if you were confused by the story, this was actually a biological female who was taking testosterone because that school district did not allow biological members of one sex to compete against the other, even if they self-identified as that sex. But they did allow exceptions to taking performance-enhancing drugs if that student self-identified as a different sex. It's confusing. But I was shocked when I did the research for my book to discover that there's actually plenty of examples of biological boys who self-identify as boys competing in girls' sports, such as the example of high school senior Will Higgins, who in 2011 competed in a girls' state swim meet in Massachusetts. He won the 50-yard freestyle race and broke the meet record with a time that would not have even qualified him to compete in the same race in the boys' division. The lead paragraph of a Boston Globe article covering the controversy was Orwellian. It said, quote, "The governing body that regulates high school athletics in Massachusetts is taking a closer look at the controversy surrounding mixed-gender swim teams and will soon address the issue of boys breaking girls' swimming records." One survey that I found that shocked me, done on schools in Pennsylvania, found that approximately 30% of schools in that state reported having boys on a girls' sports team. So here we are, saying pregnant woman is not okay, but pregnant man is. Selecting a toy based on sex is not okay, but selecting an embryo for its sex is. We celebrate science, except when it points us straight to sex differences. Here we are, but how did we get here? And what does science actually have to say? I think to understand how we got here, we have to go all the way back to the sexual revolution and to second wave feminism. A strain of thought came out of that period that essentially argued that our maleness and our femaleness are social constructs, and that the differences between the sexes is the source of perceived social inequality. Or as second wave feminist Simone de Beauvoir put it, quote, "One is not born, but rather becomes a woman." To these second-wave feminists and the proponents of the sexual revolution, equality could only be achieved between the sexes by eradicating the things that make us different. But in reality, what that meant was women eradicating or trying to abolish what makes them different from men. As Harvey Mansfield put it, sociologist and author, Harvard professor, sociologist, and author of the book Manliness, he said, quote, "Gender neutrality seems at first to disregard sexual differences, but it assumes that what was until recently specific to men is actually common to both sexes. There remains an obstacle to gender neutrality, manliness, which does not seem easily removable even in time. Men reject and resist the expectation that they should abandon their manliness. The result has been that women have been increasingly held up to and forced into a male model. We're measured against men, and I think this very much helps us to understand the origins, the philosophical origins of social ills today, like contraception, abortion, and the hookup culture. Contraception, which is sold to women as the tool for sexual equality between men, is actually simply the rendering infertile of the female body and making it like that of a man. And then you have abortion there as a fail stop when that fails. Likewise, the hookup culture is sold to women as somehow sexually empowering, but what it actually is encouraging men to behave sexually like men. But I liked the way that Carrie put it earlier. It's encouraging them to behave sexually like the worst men, not in reality how most men are. And to exemplify this, I'll read a quote from Hugh Hefner. This was an interview he did with Esquire not long before he died. He said, "Women were the major beneficiary of the sexual revolution. It permitted them to be natural sexual beings as men are. That's where feminism should have been all along. Unfortunately, within feminism, there has been a Puritan prohibitionist element that is anti-sexual. Playboy is the antidote to Puritanism. In the 1950s and 60s, there were still states that outlawed birth control, so I started funding court cases to challenge that. At the same time, I helped sponsor the lower court cases that eventually led to Roe v. Wade. We were the amicus curiae in Roe v. Wade. I was a feminist before there was such thing as feminism. That's a part of history very few people know. And so now here we are living out the logical extremes of the concept that there truly is no difference between the sexes, or rather that eradicating the differences between the sexes is the key to sexual equality. And all of this is ironic because at the same time that we've been denying for decades the differences between the sexes or trying to force androgyneity on society, science has been moving full speed ahead in the opposite direction, understanding more and more, better and better, just how inherent the differences between us are and how they truly are the key to good medicine, to good sociology. But before we get to science, I think it's important to spend a little time on the language of the debate. As George Orwell put it, if thought corrupts language, language can also corrupt thought. And one word has had a hugely corrosive effect on social thinking surrounding sex, and that word is gender. I've done a gazillion interviews on this topic, and I'm often asked, you know, in these radio interviews where you have 15 seconds to answer a question, what's the difference between sex and gender? And I've basically boiled it down to this. Sex means something, gender means nothing. Sex has a definition, a pretty uniform one that you can find in just about any medical textbook or scientific resource. It means male or female as denoted by one's chromosomes or genitalia. Period. Full stop. The definition of gender, on the other hand, is something even the gender identity movement is struggling to pin down. I give you the example of Facebook, which in 2015 experimented with moving away from the boring but scientifically straightforward choices of male or female. The social media platform expanded to offer 70-something selections that included choices like pangender, demi-boy, and two-spirit. Facebook was not expecting to get raked over the progressive coals for this inclusive gesture, but rather than praise, the company endured endless criticism for failing to include this gender or that, eventually winding up replacing all the options with a simple fill-in-the-blank, which eventually became other. One professor addressed the question of how to put down boundaries around the meaning of gender and the expansive number of choices once science is no longer relevant. He said, once we assert that the problem with gender is that we currently recognize only two of them, the obvious question to ask is, how many genders would we have to recognize in order not to be oppressive? Just how many possible gender identities are there? This is someone who actually has a PhD. The only consistent answer to this is 7 billion, give or take. There are as many possible gender identities as there are humans on the planet. Your gender can be frost or the sun or music or the sea or Jupiter or pure darkness. Your gender can be pizza. So while gender theory is completely anti-scientific, we know more and more each day about biological sex and just how essential it is to who we are and how stark the differences between men and women can be. Just in the time that my book has come out, two major studies have been released that point to this. The first was published and talked about in the Stanford Medical Journal, and it was about the differences between male and female brains. The title of the piece was Two Minds, the Cognitive Differences Between Men and Women. And the crux of the article was about hormones, that hormones, which are not socialized, they're endemic to who we are, very much shape and influence the male and female brains to function in very different ways. The second appeared actually just last month. It was published in the British Psychological Research Digest, and it found that sex differences appear now, clear sex differences in baby brains as young as 1 month old. And I couldn't help but laugh at this quote in the summary of the research. I'm sure this is very relevant to all of you parents with young babies out there. Quote, since birth, babies at this age have spent most of their time sleeping and suckling with limited eyesight, so profound socialization effects aren't going to be a factor, I'll say. And yet, the new findings reveal that sex differences in a number of brain areas are already apparent. When my book came out, people were already talking about another major study that came out of the UK that had found the same findings except in babies as young as 9 months old. So this is really groundbreaking. So what does this mean for all of us? When I talk about my book, I usually focus on the main thesis of my book, which has to do with how all of this disempowers women. But it is also very relevant to the theme of today's conference, which is marriage and family and parenting. So I'll quote from the Holy Father. He says, he said, I think in 2015, he ruffled a lot of feathers when he did. He said, a great enemy of marriage today is the theory of gender. Today there is a global war trying to destroy marriage. They don't destroy it with weapons, but with ideas. It's certain ideological ways of thinking are trying to destroy it. We have to defend ourselves from ideological colonization. And I think this is completely true, because if men and women aren't different, why band together? What is gender theory does get at the true purpose of marriage, because there is a reason that men and women come together and form a family. And you see how warped our society is when it comes to this. When around the same time that Pope Francis said this, the figure came out that 4 in 10 households were run by women. And this was something that was actually celebrated as some sort of a feminist triumph. And I think underpinning that is this idea that somehow men are not relevant, that women have been able to do what men once did, which is provide for their families. And this is something we should celebrate, setting aside all of the clear social science data that shows how harmful that is for women and for their children. But I think it's important, again, to keep Pope Francis's quote in mind when we think about marriage and marital equality between the sexes, because our culture's idea of marital equality is that men and women are only equal in a marriage if they're performing the same tasks identically, if the man and the woman are making the same amount of money, or if the man and the woman are doing the same number of chores. You'll see every year, you know, Time and a few other outlets will publish some study about how many hours of chores are men doing versus how many hours of chores are women doing. All this while, again, the social science is finding that men and women want very different things from marriage. Pew for decades has been polling women and asking them what their ideal work-life balance is. And every time the data comes out, the picture is overwhelming. The overwhelming percent of women, I think it's something like 80% of women with children under the age of 18, say that their preferred work-life balance is to either work part-time or not at all. And this has come at the same time that opportunities for women have expanded tenfold. There's another study that I think somebody might have referenced, maybe it was Carrie, that alluded to marital happiness, and that women are overwhelmingly say they're happier when they have a male breadwinner. I also think that this is relevant to us because at the end of the day, gender theory, again, as Carrie alluded to earlier, is it gets at the core of our faith. The Bible, when describing the very beginnings of human existence, clearly describes our differences. Genesis tells us, God created mankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. I'm OCD and I like sets of three. And I feel like there's a reason that was repeated three times. This is something fundamental. It's in the beginning of our central text and it's repeated three times. Our maleness and our femaleness is at the core of our identity as human beings. If we are wise, we look to these differences for deeper understanding and find a divine imprint that transcends all of creation. Why did God enter the world as a man? Why did he enter the world through a woman? How does our sex influence our purpose in life? How does it tie into our happiness? And how does the opposite sex influence our life and calling? How can we better serve one another as man and woman and together serve the greater good through family, through work, through our service to society? These are the kinds of questions whose answers will lead us to happiness and humanity closer to God. And these are the kinds of questions that society wants us to ignore. They want us to ignore these questions because their answers would unravel so many modern fallacies about abortion, contraception, and marriage. But I want to end on a positive note. Even as society on the one hand is trying so hard to deny sexual reality and to institute widespread forced androgyneity, on the other hand, it is recognizing and even celebrating sexual difference perhaps more than ever before. In the field of medicine, for example, scientists, doctors, and researchers are realizing they've only hit the tip of the iceberg when it comes to understanding how important sex is to good medicine. Pharmaceutical companies, for example, have learned that they must include both men and women in drug trials, as the female and male bodies react often very differently to the same drug. In popular culture, the, quote, gender reveal party is all the craze. An event where expecting parents make a big to-do, either at a party or on social media, about the sex of their unborn child. The internet's most visited parenting website, Baby Center, experienced in 1 year a 900% increase in threads on gender reveal parties. And in 1 6-month stretch, YouTube saw an even larger increase in gender reveal videos uploaded to the site. Single-sex education is making a major comeback. In 2004, there were only 34 single-sex public schools in America. In 2014, that number had exploded to 850. And that does not include private or parochial schools and colleges. Even some toys are getting a gender makeover, with Lego recently introducing a line of Legos tailored to girls, only to see the line become one of their best-selling, tripling their sales overall, and finally making progress towards closing that much fretted about Lego gender gap. Writer Jonathan Last called its Disney Castle set, quote, a Death Star for girls, and a 4,080-piece step towards gender equality, the kind of set that would make a girl scream uncontrollably on Christmas morning. In many cases, women are unsurprisingly the drivers for more single-sex spaces, such as women-only gyms, female-only shared working spaces, and even recreational opportunities like women-only ski clubs. And sociologists are just beginning to understand the differing ways that women engage the workforce and society for the good of all. Bill Gates attributed his decision to give away almost all of his fortune in the world to the women in his life. And in a piece for the New York Times entitled Why Men Need Women, sociologist Adam Grant documents the numerous positive ways that women influence men. My personal favorite was the finding that male CEOs pay their employees less on average when their firstborn is a son, but more if their firstborn is a girl. The reality is, to quote one of the most complex celebrities in Hollywood, Beyoncé Carter Knowles, quote, humanity requires both men and women, and we are equally important and need one another. Men and women complement each other in essential ways, and we needn't be threatened by what makes us different. To the contrary, authentic equality between the sexes that so many on both sides of the debate are seeking is only to be found by starting with recognizing, accepting, and celebrating what makes us different. As the timeless adage goes, vive la différence.
Few minutes for questions. Anyone? Questions for Ash? Yes. This side of the room is really killing you guys over there. Who's up first?
My question is just about if people are taking, like a girl taking a testosterone, like physically, what does that do? If they're arguing that just now she's taking testosterone, and so now she's male. What does that actually do physically? Like, we know from science now that our brains are different, but after so many years of taking testosterone, would a female brain actually look more male, actually respond more male?
Well, I'm not a scientist, so I don't know completely, but I do know there's sort of two approaches that are being taken now with teenagers and actually children younger than teenagers, which is disturbing. The first is, when they're sort of prepubescent, is to give them hormone blockers. Essentially, you can take drugs that block puberty. So if a child expresses gender dysphoria, now the actual position of the American Medical Association and its affiliate with pediatrics is that is the right approach to take. And I mean, there's a whole kind of debate in the scientific world about that. And there was another big study that came out 2 summers ago, I think, by the professor at Johns Hopkins, who I think many are in this room would be familiar with him. His name is slipping me right now. Yeah, he's done a lot of work on that. But the second approach is, once they are in puberty, and I think later puberty, to give hormone treatments for the opposite sex. And I don't actually know, but I can only imagine. I just know, being a woman, how much I feel even the slightest shifts in my cycle, how extraordinary of an impact that must be on the body. And it just seems so incredibly reckless to be throttling ahead with with something like that, where there's been I don't want to say so little research, because the study that McHugh came out with sort of collected the research for 50 years and put forward that in no cases is that ever really helpful to people who are experiencing gender dysphoria. But I would think it would make the female brain function more like a male brain and make women look and act more like men. And that's what happened with this wrestler. I mean, if you look at the pictures, it looks like a male, but it is a female competing against other females.
Yeah, so you were talking that the science, as you said, like no matter what society says, is male and female. That's what the scientific community is saying. How do you deal with the arguments, or do you have any scientific articles that talk about the three chromosomes, like all those exceptions, like three chromosomes for hermaphrodites, or like that, where sometimes it's used by the as a scientific argument that there's a third sex or something?
Well, there is. I mean, there is intersex is a real category, and it's an extraordinarily rare scientific phenomenon. I think it's something like 0.0002% of humans have this, and there's been a push on from the gender theory world to make that statistic seem larger than it is by including things like, you know, things other than chromosomal abnormalities. But I think there's mechanisms in place to deal with that. I know, for example, the Olympic Committee has an entire protocol for dealing with, you know, there's been, to my knowledge, one Olympian ever, and they had a protocol for dealing with that. But I think that is certainly a scientific phenomenon, but we don't need to cast aside all of the rest of science and basic common sense about the differences between men and women because there is 0.00002% of human beings who present as intersex.
One more question. Just real quick on that Abercrombie line of clothing that they've come out and promoted. It's a big deal for them. And there's some really good Catholics who... I know one who's a professor now, associate professor, who I went to school with, got her master's at a very fine Catholic college and university. And she's in a debate with me on it's okay because she's got two kids now and it's really easy for her. Now she can use one area and then find all their clothes. And they're, you know, she's debating the opposite point of view that it's okay. It really doesn't hurt society. I'm just curious of what your thoughts on like a clothing or a company like that really promoting it, changing all clothes, make it one gender clothes, one for all kids. I'm just curious of what your thought on that.
Well, I'm not familiar with the Abercrombie thing, so I'll have to look that up. They're always popping up. I mean, the last I saw, they were making their clothes more modest, so I thought that was a good thing. But I talk about androgynous clothing in my book, and I make the point that really all it is making women's clothes more like men. I mean, a T-shirt and jeans is what men wear, and that's sort of the androgynous clothing model. And all that really is sort of stigmatizing women's clothes and making it, I think it's especially sinister when it's towards children and this idea that, because I think children, and I see this with my own kids, at a very young age, they really want to start manifesting their sex. Some of the first questions my kids ever asked me were about, is he a boy or a girl? A song comes on. Is that a boy or a girl singing? And so I think this effort to sort of stamp out children's natural inclinations to express their sexual identity by saying that girls' clothing is somehow, because it's frilly, is somehow bad, is sinister, because all it's really doing is, like I said, making girls' clothes more like boys' clothes. So. Yeah, thank you.